It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. Earlier this month, Governor Tony Evers picked a sophomore from the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse to serve on the UW System's Board of Regents. We'll talk with Olivia Woodmansey about her goals as the board's new voice for students. What questions do you have for the UW System's new student regent? What would you like to know about her positions or her goals as a voice for students? 800-642-1234 is a great way to join the conversation. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Olivia, good morning. Welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much.
What made you want to apply for this position on the Board of Regents? Were you already involved in student government at UW-La Crosse?
I was. I actually began my involvement in student government right away my freshman year through different committees working with segregated fees. And from there, my involvement just grew. And I was really, really excited when I found out about this opportunity. Never in a million years did I think I would actually be able to serve on the Board of Regents. But now that I'm here, I'm excited to not only take my voice, but the voice of other students and really amplify it within the Board of Regents.
So tell us what it was like to hear that the governor had chosen you for the job.
So I actually got the announcement via email, and when I got the announcement, I almost dropped my phone right down the elevator shaft. I was so excited. It was very difficult to focus in my differential equations class after I got the news, but it was just surreal, and I began thinking, what can I do with this opportunity now? Who do I need to contact? How do I get started? How do I begin absorbing all the information I'll need in order to best serve the UW System students?
So what's the top issue you're going to urge the Board of Regents to address?
A lot of it is just dealing with student voices, making sure that students are not only heard, but their voices, their concerns for the system are heard and actually being taken into consideration when making all decisions. I know that a lot of times the board looks at upcoming years, and I know in 2025 there's a bit of a drop-off, so there are probably going to be concerns with that. But we also really need to focus on what students want now. How can we help them now as they're going through school currently? And that's really what I want to focus on, is ensuring that student voices are heard and taken into consideration.
What can you do to collect input from other students?
I'm really excited. I have a couple of initiatives already going forward, but I know within my two-year term, I'll be really looking for more innovative ways to get that student voice and make sure I'm reaching all students. One thing I definitely want to utilize is UW System Student Representatives, which is a body that is comprised of all UW System Student Association and student governments. So I'm really looking forward to working with them. In addition to that, I will be doing several campus visits and really making sure I get to know each individual campus as a body and then all UW System schools as an entity as well.
Olivia Woodmansey is the UW System Board of Regents' new student member. Are you a student at one of Wisconsin's universities or college? What do you think is important for your representative on the UW System Board of Regents to tackle? Join the conversation at 800-642-1234 or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Olivia, what about college affordability? Do you support what state lawmakers have been doing with tuition freezes?
I do believe that tuition freezes are vital to ensure that college is affordable. However, I also believe that looking from a budgetary standpoint, as that's a lot of my background, I see how those cuts affect not only in UW-La Crosse. I know faculty members for a span of 6 years didn't get a pay increase, and I think that's something that we definitely need to work on, is to ensure that if there is a tuition freeze, we have the proper funding to back up that freeze to ensure that our UW System schools are not only competitive within Wisconsin, but as universities as a whole throughout the United States.
What about mental health resources for students in the UW system? Do you think there are enough of those?
I personally do not. I know that the Board of Regents during, I believe it was their April meeting, decided to call attention to this. And I think not only was this an excellent idea, but it's something that needs to be further developed and implemented. Something that I'm really looking forward to doing is making sure that all university systems have the proper resources to ensure that mental health is taken care of and the stigma of mental health is kind of erased from the UW system schools.
You're going to be pretty busy visiting campuses across the state, talking to students. What's your plan for dealing with the balance between your responsibilities as a student regent and your own education?
I've thought about this a lot, and I'm really looking for new and innovative ways to do this. But what's really great about UW La Crosse, and I believe all UW system schools, is that I have a great support system supporting me. And so I've already been in contact with faculty members, with administration, willing to help me through this process and ensure that not only I'm holding myself accountable, but they can be there as a backbone to hold me accountable and make sure that I'm getting my studies done while still being an effective and efficient student leader.
Student regents are non-voting members of the Board of Regents of the UW system, but you can join in the board's debate. Has the Board of Regents been receptive to student concerns in the past?
I believe so. I actually had the opportunity of talking with several regents as well as the current student regent now. And not only have I heard that they call out and ask sometimes what is the student voice, how do students feel about this issue, but they also ensure that the student does have a voice in that room. However, I'm hoping in my role to further amplify this and make sure that not only are they asking for my input and the input of all students, but that they're also taking it into consideration and that we can also make a change within the system.
The Speaker of Wisconsin's State Assembly, Robin Voss, is a former student regent. You're a math and English major, and I understand you're interested in studying law. Are you also interested in following the Speaker's footsteps into politics?
As of now, I'm unsure of where my future is exactly going to take me. If you told me the beginning of my freshman year that I would be a student regent representing over 180,000 students, I probably would have laughed. So I'm definitely open to all opportunities. I'm really excited to see where fields take me, things like that. As of now, I'm not drawn to politics. I'm more drawn to law. However, I can foresee this changing as I love voicing the opinions and giving the microphone to others who don't have a voice so I can further amplify that. And I believe that politics, when properly exercised, has the ability to do that.
We mentioned that the student regent is a non-voting member of the Board of Regents. Do you mind that you can't vote? I mean, you can participate in debate, but you don't have a vote. Do you see that as a problem?
Actually, my understanding of the board is that the student regent does have a vote. And so with that vote, I hope to show everyone that I not only have an equal voice, but that I am a voting member and that I do have the ability to voice my opinion with a vote as well as with my voice.
And what's your top priority as you begin your tenure on the board? What is the first thing you want to do?
As far as policy goes, I really believe that this position is one where I need to absorb as much information as I can so I become prepared when I want to tackle an issue. If I've learned anything on my time as on student government is that I can set an agenda for what I want to do. However, different issues and policies come up all of the time. And so I can't necessarily say this is exactly what I want to do because that could potentially change in the future. And I want to make sure that throughout everything that I'm doing, I'm making sure that student voices are heard. And so that's my biggest concern is making sure that I have an open line of communication with all student associations, all student governments, but also just all students, all universities, to make sure that they know that the Board of Regents is listening to them, that we're serving them.
And what was the reaction from your fellow students at UW La Crosse when they got the news that you'd been named the new student regent?
A lot of them were just overjoyed for me. I got text messages, I got calls saying, congratulations, this is such an honor. But what also upset me was that some students didn't really realize what the Board of Regents is. And I think that definitely needs to change on universities because the Board of Regents can serve them. And also some of the policies and procedures that the Board of Regents implements, I think it would be really vital for students to know. So with my communication with universities, I hope to not only tell them what they want the Board of Regents to change, but also inform them as to what the Board of Regents is doing and how they are serving the students.
Olivia, thank you for joining us this morning. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
Olivia Woodmansey is the UW System Board of Regents' new student member. Coming up next, we learn how you can protect yourself from the latest phone scam. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. An increasing number of people are falling victim to a new type of phone scam where victims are asked to confirm their supposedly compromised Social Security number and pay to unfreeze their account from the Federal Reserve. How does this scam work and how can we protect ourselves? Well, we're going to find that out. So stick around. Have you fallen victim to this type of scam or have you gotten one of these calls? What happened? What questions do you want our expert to answer about how to protect yourself and others from this phone scam? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas at WPR.org. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Laura Sutherland is administrator for the Division of Trade and Consumer Protection at the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture Trade and Consumer Protection. Good morning and welcome to the Ideas Network, Laura.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Tell us about this new scam called the Social Security Imposter Scam. What is it and how does it work?
Thanks, John. Yeah, it's a new variation on a theme of an imposter scam. Imposter scams often take the form of someone calling and pretending like they're part of the government or another entity that you trust. And this version is people calling and suggesting that they are with the Social Security Administration and that your call has been and your account has been compromised and that you need to call them immediately to address the issue. Typically, it comes in the form of a robocall, and they often threaten arrest if you don't call them back, and they give you a fake 1-800 number to call. So there's, you know, some obvious red flags here. The Social Security Administration is not going to call and threaten you with arrest if you don't call them back, first of all. But the call tells you that your account is compromised and that you need to call them and give them vital information like your banking information, your Social Security number, so they can resolve it for you.
And this sounds an awful lot like the IRS phone scam. When did this one start to show up?
The IRS scam, right, has been happening for some time, but the Social Security Administration scam has actually peaked and topped the IRS scam in terms of the damage that it's caused. The Federal Trade Commission has reported that in February alone, consumers have lost $19 million to this scam, which is kind of amazing when you think about how it works. Scammers are calling and asking you to give them their banking information and give you a gift card and the code numbers on the back of the gift card to resolve your compromised account. And of course, the Social Security Administration is never going to do that. What happens is you get a robocall and you're asked to call this 1-800 number. And the other thing that the scammers are doing is they're spoofing the Social Security Administration phone number. They are actually using the accurate number, but it is obviously not the Social Security Administration. So we tell consumers to do some basic things. First of all, don't answer the phone. Even if you see a Social Security Administration number on your caller ID, they're not going to call you out of the blue. Chances are, if there's some concerns with your account, they're going to send you a letter. They're going to reach out to you with basic, you know, snail mail, like the government is often want to do. And if you have a concern about your Social Security account, you should call the Social Security Administration yourself. You should initiate the contact and make sure that you know you're speaking with a government official and not responding to a scam call.
And the Social Security system website, the Social Security Administration website, also has a contact function as well. So you could go online and look at your account and check to see that all was well, and you wouldn't even have to talk to anybody.
That's correct. You can go online and set up a secure account and communicate with the government that way. And we certainly recommend you doing that. But whatever you do, you don't give your Social Security number to an unsolicited caller, nor do you give any banking information. And in no uncertain terms should you pay a government official with a gift card. And again, this sounds kind of surprising, but as I say, it is topped out the federal the FTC's complaint reporting in February and April. And it's true for Wisconsin, too. The Social Security Administration scam is the largest scam that we've seen in April. So we really are encouraging folks to talk to the people in their life. They may not fall prey to it, but perhaps your grandparents will, your great aunts, your parents. You know, talk to your family members about these scams. Alert them to them, and check in with them regularly about the types of calls that they're getting and any kind of unusual activity they may be having.
You mentioned giving up your Social Security number. That's got to be kind of the holy grail for scammers. How valuable is a Social Security number to a scammer?
It's extremely valuable, and it's very difficult to unring that bell once you've given that out. If you visit DadCap's website, we have a lot of helpful information about how to keep your personal identifying information secure. And if you are concerned about identity theft or a compromised Social Security number, we have some great information about how to initiate a credit freeze. And we actually have an individual that will talk to you on the phone and walk you through some of these issues. Our phone number, if you want to give DadCap a call for any information, is 1-800-422-7128.
Lara Sutherland is Administrator for the Division of Trade and Consumer Protection at the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade and Consumer Protection. We're talking about the latest phone scam, this one involving Social Security Administration imposters. I did also notice that there's another phone scam out there that's kind of related to the imposter Social Security Administration imposter scam. This one involves Medicare imposters claiming to be calling about your pain management and that you need to call them back or something really horrible will happen. I was getting about six or seven of these a day for a while, and then they suddenly stopped. What is it that makes the elderly such a target for scammers, do you think?
Well, I think it's a good question. I think that oftentimes the older you get, the slightly more concerned you are about your safety and your security. And not everybody, but many people in their older years get more concerned about being compromised and somewhat more protective of their personal information. The reality is that consumers, that scammers are simply trying to contact as many people as they can. I mean, what's fascinating about these robocalls is it doesn't take an inordinate number of them for them to catch a couple fish on the line, if you will, and get a significant amount of money. So while many people are aware that these are scams and that they know better to respond, only a few people need to respond for scammers rather to be successful and make a fair amount of money on these sweeping robocalls. So you're correct. You see it in areas where elderly people are going to look for a secure counterpart. So any governmental official, oftentimes you see it in utility scams, any area in which a elderly person could feel particularly vulnerable if something went wrong, Medicare, IRS, Social Security, your utilities, etc.
So if you suspect that a friend or family member may be at risk of becoming a victim from the scam, what should you do to help them?
That's a great question. Again, you should call our hotline at 1-800-422-7128, or you can reach out to our website at dadcap.wi.gov. We have some excellent information about ID theft, credit freezes. You can also reach us at dadcap hotline@wisconsin.gov. And if you're concerned, again, about your Social Security number being compromised, DadCap can help you, or you can call the Social Security Administration at 1-800-722-1213. That's 1-800-722-1213. And John, as you mentioned earlier in the call, setting up an account with the Social Security Administration would be an excellent idea, and working with your grandparents or your parents to do so they don't fall victim to this scam would be a great prophylactic.
And I think their website is ssa.gov, if memory serves, which it often doesn't. Let's say someone's already fallen victim to the scam. Is there anything that they can do to get their money and their identity back?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I should clarify that. You certainly can work with our organization to help protect your identity and get your identity back. It can be a very arduous process, but certainly people have been successful in doing so, and we encourage you to contact our organization and help you with your identity. When it comes to money, oftentimes the scammers are from overseas, as you probably know. And if you've given them money via a gift card, it's virtually impossible to get that money back. That's why we really encourage education in this space, because once the money's been given away, it's very, very difficult for regulators and enforcement to get it back. Filing a complaint, though, is still important. A lot of these phone numbers are tracked by the federal government, and they lead to the creation of a list of numbers that are used for many of the stopping robocall applications that both the major carriers use and the ones that you can get online. So we encourage you to file a complaint regardless.
All right, Laura, thank you so much for joining us this morning. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me on.
Laura Sutherland is Administrator for the Division of Trade and Consumer Protection at the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade and Consumer Protection. The news is next, and then we'll hear about an effort to strengthen Wisconsin's drunk driving laws. Stay tuned for that. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. In a state where drinking is embedded in the culture and most people wouldn't consider watching a Packers game without a beer, a group of Wisconsin lawmakers are proposing a handful of bills to strengthen Wisconsin's drunk driving laws. Corrine Hess reports this could mean Wisconsin might finally criminalize first-time OWIs.
Jennifer Kilburn is walking on a treadmill in her Kenosha home. Today, that's an accomplishment. In the past, there were only two things that could keep the 41-year-old from being outside, her 12-hour nursing shift or the pouring rain. But on August 9th, everything changed.
I was T-boned by a drunk driver. I don't remember the accident at all.
Jennifer was taken by Flight for Life to Milwaukee.
My pelvis was broken into over 20-some-odd pieces. My thigh bone had gone right through my pelvis, and it pushed my intestines right through my diaphragm and into my left lung cavity.
The accident was on a Thursday. Jennifer was unconscious until Saturday.
Luckily, I had family and friends around me that were telling me where I was at and what had happened, I guess over and over again until it finally sunk in that I had been on my way to work and I had been hit by a drunk driver. And the surprising thing about it was that the guy who hit me had been pulled over 2 hours prior for drunk driving.
26-year-old Jesse Liddell had been arrested at 2:20 a.m. for drunk driving in Pleasant Prairie. Wisconsin is the only state that does not criminalize drunk driving on the first offense. It is treated as a traffic violation. State law allowed Liddell to be released to his mother. She promised not to let him drive. But he did, and smashed into Jennifer's silver Honda at 4:50 a.m. A handful of bills in the state legislature would stiffen the penalties for drinking and driving. One would criminalize a first operating while intoxicated offense as a misdemeanor. If passed, it would increase the penalty to a $500 fine, 30 days in jail, or both. State Representative Jim Ott introduced the drunk driving bills.
There's too much drunk driving in Wisconsin. Too many people are injured. Too many people are killed, too many wrong-way drivers, too many people being smashed into.
Wisconsin lawmakers also want offenders to stay in jail until they are sober and to appear in court if they receive an OWI citation. If a person kills someone drinking and driving, Ott wants them to serve a 5-year prison sentence. If they've been convicted 5 or 6 times for an OWI, he wants the fine to be $25,000, up to 10 years in prison, or both. Detractors argue the state's court system can't handle the influx.
As far as flooding the court system, you know what? I don't care if it floods the court system. If somebody commits a crime, they ought to go before the judge.
Neighboring states have stricter laws. In Minnesota, a first offense is punishable by 90 days in jail and a $1,000 fine. In Illinois, the fine is $2,500 and up to 1 year in jail. But not everyone agrees harsher penalties are the right answer for Wisconsin. Jim Hazley has taught a class for first-time OWI offenders at Waukesha County Technical College for 45 years. Hazley believes educating people about Wisconsin's laws and potential consequences is more effective.
If we had to have 1/3 more people go through of our circuit courts, we'd have even a bigger backlog.
The state's powerful Tavern League hasn't opposed OTS bills, but league lobbyist Scott Stanger says the group doesn't think they will pass.
There's been a combination of programs and laws that seem to be most effective when they're targeted at education, a treatment, and then programs to change people's behavior, like safe ride and rideshare programs.
It took about 3 months, 4 months before I was able to really walk.
Before the accident, Jennifer was a fitness enthusiast and an avid runner. She underwent 5 surgeries during her 15 days in the hospital. Doctors have told her she won't run again.
If the law had been different, if he hadn't been able to be signed out, then he wouldn't have hit me. It wouldn't have happened. Since I can't change what, I can't go back and change what happened to me, I'd like to prevent this from happening to somebody else in the future.
This is not the first time lawmakers have tried to strengthen Wisconsin's drunk driving laws. But this session, it could gain traction. A handful of Republican lawmakers support it, and Democratic Governor Tony Evers says he believes it is time to make a change. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You can read more about this story and see the rest of our series, High Tolerance, at WPR.org/alcohol. According to a state audit, overtime hours in Wisconsin prisons have jumped by more than 50% over the last 5 years. As Wisconsin's prison staffing shortage continues, the state is seeking ways to attract workers and keep them. We're going to talk about those initiatives and why some state workers are not happy about this situation. Do you work in a correctional institution in Wisconsin? What's your job? What do you like or dislike about your job? Have you had to work overtime? And how often? Maybe you once worked at a Wisconsin correctional institution. How long did you work there? Why did you leave? And what job did you take instead? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234, the number to call to join our conversation. Email address is ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. John Eason is an associate professor of sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He is the author of Big House on the Prairie, Rise of the Rural Ghetto and Prison Proliferation. John, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me back.
So why are Wisconsin prisons facing a worker shortage?
That is actually a very good question. I think part of the issue is attracting workers, given the fact that Act 10 has destabilized the unions, and the conditions in prisons are increasingly unsafe for staff as well as for inmates.
Are workers in Wisconsin correctional institutions and facilities opting to work overtime, or do they really not have a choice?
I'd imagine they don't have a choice. I've heard on a program prior to this, several programs before, in Alabama, it feels like in states where they don't even have a history of unions, the workers were forced into work here because they're so short on staff, they have to cover those shifts. So part of the dangerous conditions in prisons are because the workers are working so many hours, and if you don't have any way to protect them from working too many hours, it also creates a dangerous condition for them.
And news reports are quoting people as saying they're working 12 and a half, 13-hour days in the state's correctional institutions, and sometimes working up to 80 hours a week. That just seems really, really crazy. How did we get to this point?
I think this is following broader trends in employment overall. If you think about this, you can liken corrections officers to truck drivers in this sense, that if you work too many hours, the performance at your job, given it is safety related, is going to go way down. But all of us across the board are working more hours, especially in Wisconsin. We're being asked to do more with less, I think, is a model that, you know, has been influenced coming out of Southern culture. As Wisconsin deregulates more and more of its industries.
As I mentioned, some of these employees are working twice as much as normal. Colleagues say this causes fatigue and strains, also strains relationships with friends and family. And so they're making this overtime pay, but their family is paying a cost. What do we know about this?
Well, we know that studies are sort of mixed in terms of correctional officers and domestic violence, for instance. Some studies show that corrections officers have increased domestic violence. Others show that they don't necessarily, but it's a very thorny issue. I think that AFSCME, you know, even though the corrections officers have split from AFSCME, they're still trying to advocate on behalf of the corrections workers because the conditions are so bad where guards are frequently being injured as well. So it's not only what's happening at home, it's also what's happening to them, and they're probably taking what's happened to them at work, whether it's an injury or just a horrible day, home with them. So that's going to affect their relationships at home as well.
John Eason is an associate professor of sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. There were more than 300 inmate assaults or attempted assaults of employees in each of the last 5 years. How much does this contribute to the high turnover rate and the difficulty of attracting new workers?
Well, a place that's violent because it's not safe is definitely no one wants to work in those conditions, right? That's a pretty easy reason to push people away. The turnover rate in southern prisons, where there's a much higher, there's a much lower standard of work conditions, contributes to that. Private prisons as well don't have as good a working condition, but you don't have that issue here in Wisconsin because there aren't as many private prisons, and you do still have this history of recent unionization, but that's why this is a social experiment where costs have increased and safety has decreased since Act 10. This is directly related to the labor market being deregulated, especially in an industry that's so reliant on safety. It's going to get even worse. It's sort of catastrophic. I come at this question from the prison abolitionist perspective. My work was informed by that. But I think even a prison abolitionist would have to say that if you want to decrease prisoners, if you want to decrease our over-reliance on prisons, the last thing you'd want to do is get rid of the corrections officers first.
John Eason is an associate professor of sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Our conversation continues in a moment. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. A recent state audit showed that overtime at Wisconsin's prisons jumped by 50% over the last 5 years. There are significant problems with recruitment and retention in the prison system, and we're talking about that with John Eason, Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's the author of Big House on the Prairie, Rise of the Rural Ghetto, and Prison Proliferation. We want to hear from you. Do you work in a correctional institution in Wisconsin? What's your job? What do you like or dislike about it? Have you had to work overtime and how often? Did you work at a Wisconsin correctional institution in the past? How long did you work there and why did you leave? What job did you take instead? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. John Eason, you described yourself just a moment ago as a prison abolitionist. What does that mean?
That means someone who wants to reduce our over-reliance on mass incarceration in the U.S. Basically, we have too many people that are incarcerated. There's over 2.2 million people incarcerated. And actually, we have about 450,000 correction officers in the U.S.
Governor Evers' budget calls for spending an additional $23.8 million to implement a pay progression system for guards, sergeants, and psychiatrists who work for the DOC and the State Department of Health Services. This month, he gave temporary raises of up to $5 an hour to workers at six prisons. Is that enough to make a real difference?
I think that's a move in the right direction, given that the turnover rate for guards grew from 18% to 26%, according to that same report you referenced earlier. And the vacancy rate for all security positions increased from 7% to 14%. But your producer just gave me a great insight during the during the break. It's created a condition that can be akin to a tinderbox, because the prison, the adult inmate population grew from just under 22,000 to 23,600 from 2011 to 2018 during that same period. So you have an increase in people in prison and a decrease in people taking care of them. That it's a tinderbox, so that's why people don't want to work there.
The Department of Corrections is attempting to retain workers through training academies at the six institutions that have temporary pay increases. Guard applicants work alongside guards, and some of the prisons are holding job fairs. Are those also steps in the right direction?
Those are steps in the right direction, but again, this is – so Governor Evers is this is such a complicated issue because Governor Evers, on one hand, is trying to reduce our over-reliance on mass incarceration. He wouldn't necessarily call himself a prison abolitionist, right? But we're in an era where we're overall across the country, even conservative, fiscally conservative Republicans are trying to reduce our over-reliance on mass incarceration. But if you over-invest in attracting new guards, you're going to strengthen people who don't want to lose their job, right? So if we try and reduce the number of people in prison, that's going to directly affect the people wanting to keep their jobs. So this is very complicated.
We have a caller, Jamal, in Onalaska. Jamal, good morning. Welcome to the morning show.
Good morning.
Yes, go ahead.
So, I am not a prison guard, but I'm a county guard. And we have a few guys that actually leave the prison to come to the county. And the number one reason they always say is paying overtime. But the thing I think is a little weird is county is not that much different than prison for overtime-wise. Do you have any ideas of how to retain people? I've been there at my place for almost a year, and I think we've been close to 13 officers through, in and out. So just looking for your input, I guess.
Okay, so county jails looking at some of the same problems that our state prison system is. John Eason?
Yeah, this speaks to everyone having multiple jobs. You know, there was a joke recently told by a congressman that unemployment's so low because everyone has multiple jobs, right? But we really have an issue. The unemployment figures, that's a whole other argument once you start to actually count the prison population, which could be counted in unemployment. But to his point, everyone is working more than 40 hours a week, right? Everyone's working. If you're employed, you have a job and a half or two. So we've seen that wages have been flat or gone down the last 30 or 40 years. So most people are working more hours to compensate for the rising cost of living.
Some employees in Wisconsin's prison system putting in twice as many hours as a typical American worker. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel recently wrote that a Dodge Correctional Institution sergeant made more than $180,000 in 2018, $112,000 of that coming from overtime. Does working all those extra hours create a higher burnout rate for these positions?
It certainly would. Prison. We need to just face this from the beginning of this conversation. Prisons are not nice places, right? And we've made them less hospitable since 1970. So it's not only inhospitable for people who live there, people who are incarcerated, it's less hospitable for people who are taking care of them. So if you have to see what's going on in terms of the human suffering in prison every day, it's going to affect you psychologically and increase the likelihood of you leaving that position.
State workers can boost their pensions by putting in long hours as they near retirement. Do we see this happening with prison workers as well?
I'd imagine so. I don't see why they wouldn't do that. It only makes sense. There's a number of people trying to get out of even being a police officer earlier. We have nearly a million police officers across the country. And these aren't even the most dangerous jobs. The conditions are just not the best conditions, right? Who wants to see what's happening in prison? You know, I was recently at a church event, and I was talking with people about part of their civic duty or church duty is to go and visit people in prison. And churches aren't even they're not going to see members in prison as much because it's a tough task. It's a tall tale to go into a prison.
The Department of Corrections Secretary Kevin Carr said in a letter to auditors that unless the agency can get control of vacancies, things probably won't change. What should correctional facilities be doing to attract and keep workers?
I think that the push to get more workers, I think Governor Evers has done the right thing to get more workers. The retention rate is, I think, the bigger issue. And there's things that that workers did prior to Act 10 to be able to make it a respectable, not just a job. It's become a job instead of a profession. The standards were better in terms of hours, in terms of conditions, in terms of demands for safety. And if you can't, if you don't have leverage to bargain for those things for basic safety, that's why we're seeing increased violence in these facilities. If they want to really retain workers, they're going to have to really change the conditions of employment.
So, we're about out of time here. So what I'll do is I'll thank you very much for joining us, John Eason. I really appreciate your time this morning.
John, as always, it's been a pleasure. Thank you guys for having me.
John Eason is an associate professor of sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's also the author of the book Big House on the Prairie, Rise of the Rural Ghetto and Prison Proliferation. This is The Morning Show. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. Kate will be back tomorrow. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.